Why are you smiling like that, Blue Jay?
The piper came up to him and drove his fist into Moe's stomach, doubling him up. The swift above their heads cried out.
Do you think your fiery friend will come to make amends for betraying you?
The silver-nosed man whispered.
Don't rejoice too soon. This time I'm going to chop off his head. We'll see if he can come back from the dead without that.
The Blue Jay would have liked to thrust the bookbinder's knife into that heartless breast. But once again Moe, the bookbinder, sent him away.
What are you waiting for? Asked the jay. The white book? No one's going to find it.
Well then, Moe retorted, why should I fight any more? Without the book I'm dead anyway, and so is my daughter.
Maggie.
The bookbinder and the Blue Jay were the same man, only in sharing their fears for her. The door opened, and a small, thin figure made its way into the firelit hall. Jacopo. He came toward Moe, taking small steps. Did he want to tell the Blue Jay about his mother? Or had his grandfather sent him to find out how Moe was getting on with binding the new book? Violante's son stopped close to Moe, but he was looking at the piper.
Will it soon be ready?
He asked.
If you don't keep him from his work,
replied the silver-nosed man. Jacopo put a hand under his tunic and brought out a book. He had wrapped it in a brightly coloured cloth.
I want the Blue Jay to cure this book for me. It's my favourite.
He opened it, and Moe forgot to breathe. Pages soaked in blood. Jacopo was looking at him.
Your favourite book? There's only one book the Blue Jay's supposed to bother with, so get out!
The piper poured himself a goblet of wine.
Go to the kitchen and tell them to send up more meat and wine. I only wanted to take a look at it.
Jacopo's voice sounded as defiant as ever.
Grandfather said I could get him to do that. You can ask him if you like.
He was passing Moe a short, worn pencil that could easily be hidden in the hand. That was better than the knife. Much, much better. The piper put a piece of meat in his mouth and washed it down with wine.
You're lying,
he said.
Has your grandfather told you what I do to liars?
No.
What?
Jacopo thrust out his chin, just as his mother did, and took a step toward the silver-nosed man. The piper wiped his greasy fingers on a snow-white napkin and smiled. Moe clutched the pencil in his fingers and opened the white book.
First I cut their tongues out,
said the piper. Jacopo took another step toward him.
Oh, yes.
Heart. Moe's fingers shook as he traced each letter.
Yes, after all, it's not easy to tell lies without a tongue. Although, wait, I did once know a mute beggar who told me shameless lies. He talked with his fingers. So?
The piper laughed.
So I cut them off, one by one.
Keep looking up, Moe, or he'll realize that you're writing. Blood. Only one more word now. A single word. The piper glanced at him. He looked at the open book. Moe hid the pencil in his closed fist. The swift spread her wings again. She wanted to help him.
No, Risa.
But the bird was already in the air, flying above the piper's head.
I saw that bird before, said Jacopo, in my grandfather's bedchamber. Did you indeed?
The piper looked at the ledge where the swift had now settled. He snatched a crossbow from one of the soldiers.
No, Risa, fly away.
Just one more word, but all Moe saw was the little bird. The piper shot, and the swift fluttered upward. The arrow missed, and she flew straight into the piper's face.
Right, Moe.
He pressed the pencil down onto the blood-soaked paper. The piper's silver nose slipped when he struck out at the swift.
Death.
Chapter 76 White Knight.
The Adderhead was freezing. He was freezing even in his sleep, although he clutched the cushion to his sore chest, the cushion containing the book that protected him from eternal cold. Even his dreams, heavy with poppy juice, couldn't warm him anymore. dreams of the tortures he would inflict on the Blue Jay. Once he had dreamed only of love in this castle. But wasn't that only right and proper? Hadn't the love he found here tormented him as much as his rotting flesh? Oh, how cold he was! Even his dreams seemed to be covered with hoarfrost. Dreams of torture, dreams of love. He opened his eyes, and the painted walls stared at him with the eyes of Violante's mother. That damn poppy juice. This damn castle. And why was the fire back? The Adderhead groaned and pressed his hands to his eyes, but the sparks seemed to burn even beneath his lids. Red, red and gold, light as sharp as a knife blade, and out of the fire came the whispering he had feared ever since he first heard it at a dying man's side. Trembling, he peered through his swollen fingers. No, no, it couldn't be true. It was the poppy juice making him imagine them. Nothing else. He saw four of them all standing around his bed, white as snow. No, whiter. And they were whispering the name he had been born with, over and over again, as if to remind him that he hadn't always had the skin of a serpent. It was the poppy juice, only the poppy juice. The adder had thrust a trembling hand into the cushion to take out the book, to hold it up, and so ward them off. But their white fingers were already reaching into his breast. How they were looking at him, with the eyes of all the dead he had sent to them. And then they whispered his name again, and his heart stood still. Chapter 77 Over The white woman appeared as soon as Mo closed the blood-soaked book again. At the sight of her, the piper forgot the swift, and Violante's son hid under the table to which Mo was chained. But this daughter of death hadn't come to take the Blue Jay away. She was here to give him his freedom, and Risa saw the relief on Mo's face. At that moment he forgot everything. Risa saw that too. Perhaps he hoped for a split second that the story had been told to the end at last. But the piper hadn't died with his master. For a few precious moments, fear held him transfixed. But when the white woman disappeared, she took his fear with her, and Risa spread her wings once more. She spat out the seeds as she flew at the piper, so that she would get back hands she could use to help, feet that could run. But the bird was reluctant to leave her, and she still had claws as she landed on the flagstones right beside the two men. Mo looked down at her in alarm, and before Risa could realize what danger she was putting him in, the piper had taken the chains binding him to the table to wind them around his own hand. Mo fell to his knees as the piper tugged the chains. He was holding the knife he had been using to cut paper, but what good was a bookbinder's knife against a sword or a crossbow? Desperately, Risa fluttered up on the table, retching in the frantic hope that there might be a seed still under her tongue. But her feathery prison would not let her go, and the piper pulled at Mo's chains again.
"Your pale angel was in a hurry to leave this time," he said scornfully. "Why didn't she undo your chains for you? But don't worry, we'll leave you plenty of time to die. Time enough for your white friends to come back again. Now go on working."
With difficulty, Mo straightened up. "Why should I?" he asked, pushing the white book over to the piper. "Your master won't be needing any second book now. That's why the white woman came here. I've written the three words in this one. See for yourself. The Adderhead is dead." The piper stared at the blood-stained binding. Then he looked under the table where Jacopo was cowering like a small, frightened animal.
"Is he indeed?" he said, drawing his sword. "Well, if that's so, I've no objection to immortality myself. So as I said, go on working."
His soldiers began to whisper.
"Quiet,"
the piper snapped, pointing to one of them with his gloved hand.
"You, go to the Adderhead and tell him the Blue Jay claims he's dead."
The soldier hurried away. The others watched him go with fear in their eyes. But the piper put the point of his sword to Mo's chest.
"You're not working yet."
Moe stepped as far back as the chains would allow, the knife in his hand.
There won't be any other book. No book with white pages.
Off you go, Jacopo. Run to your mother and tell her everything will be all right.
Jacopo crawled out from under the table and ran for it. The piper didn't even look at him as he disappeared.
When the Adderhead's son was born, I advised him to dispose of Cosimo's little bastard, he said, looking at the white book. But he wouldn't hear of it. Stupid of him.
The soldier he had sent to the Adderhead came stumbling back into the dark hall, out of breath.
The Jay is telling the truth, he gasped. The Adderhead is dead, and the white women are everywhere.
The other soldiers lowered their crossbows.
Let's go back to Umbra, sir, stammered one of them. This castle is bewitched. We can take the Blue Jay with us.
A good idea, said the piper,
and he smiled. No. Risa fluttered into his face once more, pecking the smile from his lips. It was the bird who did it, or was it the woman, the wife? She heard Moe cry out as the piper struck at her with his sword. The blade cut deep into her wing. She fell, and suddenly she had human limbs again, as if the piper had cut the bird out of her. The piper stared at her in disbelief, but as he raised his sword, Moe thrust the knife deep into his chest, right through his expensive clothes. And the piper looked at him in astonishment as he died. His soldiers, however, were still there. Moe snatched the piper's sword and drove them back away from his wife. But there were too many of them, and he was still chained to the table. Soon there was blood everywhere, on his chest, on his hands and arms. Was it his own? They were going to kill him, and once again Risa could only watch, stand by and watch, as she had done so often in the course of this story. But suddenly fire was consuming the chains, and Dustfinger stood over her to protect her, with the marten on his shoulder. Beside him stood Jacopo.
Is she dead too?
Risa heard the boy ask, as the soldiers ran from the fire, screaming.
No, Dustfinger answered. It's only her arm that's wounded.
But she was a bird, said Jacopo.
Yes, that was Moe's voice. Don't you think that sounds like a good story?
It was suddenly so quiet in the great hall. No more fighting, no screams, only the crackling of the fire as it talked to Dustfinger. Moe kneeled down beside Risa. There was blood everywhere. But he was alive, and once again she had a human hand to take his. And all was well.
Chapter 78. Staked on the Wrong Card.
Orpheus was reading frantically. He realized that himself. He was reading in too loud a voice and much too fast, as if his tongue were trying to thrust the words through the bookbinder's body like knives. He had written him the torments of hell in revenge for the piper's mocking smile. That smile still haunted him. How small it had made him, just when he was feeling so full of grandeur.
But at least there'd soon be no more smiling for the Blue Jay.
Ironstone stirred the ink and looked at him anxiously.
His fury obviously showed clearly on his face, written there in small beads of sweat.
Concentrate, Orpheus, he told himself, and tried again. There were a few words that he could hardly decipher because the letters ran together so unsteadily, drunk with his rage. Why did he feel as if he were reading the words into a void? Why did they seem like pebbles being dropped down a well where their echo was lost in the darkness? Something was wrong. He'd never felt like this before when he was reading aloud.
Ironstone, he ordered the glass man. Run to the Hall of 1,000 Windows and see how the Blue Jay is doing. He ought to be doubled up in agony like a poisoned dog by now.
The glass man lowered the twig he was using to stir the ink and looked at him in alarm.
But, master, I don't know the way.
Don't make such a stupid fuss. Or do you want me to ask the nightmare if it fancies a glass man for a change?
Turn right outside this room and then go straight ahead. Ask the guards the way.
Unhappily, Ironstone set off.
Silly creature.
Fenolia really might have thought up a less ridiculous kind of assistant to help scribes. But that was the trouble with this world. At heart, It was childish. Why had he loved the book so much when he was a child? Well, for that very reason. But now he was grown up, and it was time this world grew up, too. Another sentence, and once again the strange feeling that the words were dying away even before he spoke them. Damn it! Dizzy with rage, he was reaching for the inkwell to throw it at the painted wall when he suddenly heard loud shouts outside. Orpheus put the inkwell back on the table and listened. What was all this? He opened his door and looked down the corridor. There were no guards outside the Adderhead's bedchamber anymore, and two servants ran past him in a state of great agitation. By all the devils in hell, what did this mean? And why was Dustfinger's fire burning on the walls again? Orpheus hurried out into the passage and stopped outside the Adderhead's door. It was open, and the Silver Prince lay dead on his bed, his eyes open so wide that it wasn't difficult to guess what his last sight had been. Instinctively, Orpheus looked around before he went up to the bed. But of course the white women had left long ago. They had what they'd been waiting so long for. But how? How had it happened?
Yes, you'll have to look for a new master, Four Eyes.
Thumbling came out from behind the hangings of the bed and gave him a hawkish smile. Orpheus saw the ring that the Adderhead had used to seal death sentences on his lean hand. Thumbling was also wearing the Silver Prince's sword.
"Let's hope the stink washes out," he murmured to Orpheus in a confidential tone,
as he flung his master's heavy velvet coat over his shoulders. Then he strode away, down the corridor where Dustfinger's fire whispered along the walls. But Orpheus stood there feeling the tears run down his nose. All was lost. He'd staked everything on the wrong card. He'd put up with the stench of the rotting prince, bowed low to him, and wasted his time in this dark castle, all for nothing. It wasn't he who had written the last song, but Fenolio. Who else could it have been? And presumably the Blue Jay featured as the hero again, while Orpheus was the villain. No, worse, he played the ridiculous part of the loser. He spat in the Adderhead's rigid face and stumbled back to his room, where the useless words still lay on the table. Trembling with rage, he picked up the inkwell and poured its contents over what he had written.
"Master! Master! Have you heard?"
The glass man, out of breath, was standing in the doorway. He was quick on his spidery legs, you had to give him that.
"Yes, I know. The Adderhead's dead. What about the Blue Jay?"
"They're fighting. He and the Piper are fighting."
"Aha! Well, perhaps Silvernose may run him through yet. That would at least be something."
Orpheus snatched up his things and stuffed them into the fine leather bag he had brought from Umbra. Pens, parchment, even the empty inkwell, the silver candelabrum that the Adderhead had given him, and, of course, the three books, Jacopo's and the two about the Blue Jay. He wasn't giving up yet. Not he. He picked up the glass man and put him in the pouch at his belt.
"What are you going to do, Master?"
asked Ironstone anxiously.
"We'll summon the Nightmare and get out of this castle."
"The Nightmare's gone, Master. They say the Fire Dancer sent it up in smoke."
"Damn, damn, damn, of course.
That was why fire was burning on the walls again. Dustfinger had recognized the Nightmare. He had seen who was breathing there in the heart of darkness. Well, Orpheus, you'll just have to read yourself another Nightmare out of Jacopo's book," he thought. It wasn't all that difficult. Only this time, he must give it a name that Dustfinger didn't know. He listened for sounds in the corridor. Nothing. The rats had deserted the sinking ship. The Adderhead was alone in death. Orpheus went back into the bedchamber where his bloated corpse lay and stole what silver he could find. But Thumbling hadn't missed much. Then he hurried with the wailing glassman to the tunnel that had brought the Piper to the castle. Water was running down the stone walls, as if the passage were sticking in the lake's moist flesh like a thorn. The guards posted on the bank to keep watch on the way out were gone, but a few dead soldiers lay among the rocks. In the end, they had clearly killed one another in their panic. Orpheus took a sword from one of the dead men, but threw it away again when he discovered how heavy it was. Instead, he took a knife from another dead man's belt and put the soldier's coarse cloak over his shoulders. It might look ugly,
but it was warm.
"Where are we going, Master?"
faltered Ironstone.
"Back to Umbra."
"Why would we want to go back there?" was all that Orpheus replied as he looked up at the dark slopes barring the way to the north. To the north. He had no idea what to expect there. As with so much else in his book, Fenolio had written nothing about it, and that was just why he would go north. The mountains looked far from inviting, with their snowy peaks and bleak slopes. But it was the best way to go now that Umbra, he supposed, would soon belong to Violante and the Blue Jay. To hell with that wretched bookbinder, to the hottest hell the human mind can imagine, he thought, and made Dustfinger freeze in eternal ice until his treacherous fingers break off. Orpheus looked back at the bridge one last time before making for the trees. There went the Silver Prince's soldiers, running away. And what were they running away from? Two men and their white guardian angels, and their lord's bloated body.
"Master, master, couldn't you put me on your shoulder? Suppose I fall out of this pouch,"
the glass man wailed. "Then I'll need a new glass man," Orpheus replied. Northward, into unwritten country. Yes, he thought, as his feet, with difficulty, sought a way up the steep slope. Maybe that part of this world will obey my words. Chapter 79. Leaving. The Piper's sword had cut deep into Rhys's arm, but Brianna had learnt a good deal from her mother, even though she liked singing to Violante better than growing herbs in stony fields. "The arm will heal," she said as she bound up the wound. But the bird would never leave Rhysa now. Silvertongue knew that as well as Dustfinger. The Piper had done his best to send the Blue Jay after his master to his death. He had wounded him in the shoulder and on the left arm, but in the end he alone had followed the Adderhead, and Dustfinger made the fire consume both his body and his master's. Pale-faced, Violante stood at Silvertongue's side as the Adderhead and the Piper turned to ashes. She looked younger, as if she had shed a few years in the cell where her father had flung her, almost as forlorn as a child. Yet when she turned away at last from the fire devouring her father, she put her arm around her son. Dustfinger had never seen her do a thing like that before. Everyone still disliked Jacopo, though he had saved them all. Even Silvertongue with his soft heart felt the same, though he was ashamed of it. Dustfinger saw it in his face. There were still a dozen of Violante's child soldiers alive. They found them in the dungeon cells, but the Adderhead soldiers had all gone, like the white women. Only their abandoned tents still stood on the banks of the lake, with the black coach and a few riderless horses. Jacopo claimed that his great-grandfather's man-eating fish had come up from the lake and eaten some of the men as they ran for their lives over the bridge. Neither Silvertongue nor Violante believed him, but Dustfinger went out onto the bridge and found a few shimmering scales on the wet stones, as large as linden leaves. So they didn't take the bridge, but left the castle in the lake by the tunnel down which the Piper had come. It was snowing when they stepped out into the open, and the castle disappeared behind them among the swirling snowflakes, as if it were dissolving into the whiteness. The world around them was as still as if it had used up all words, as if all the tales there were to tell in this world had now been told. Dustfinger found Orpheus's tracks in the frozen mud of the bank, and Silvertongue looked at the trees into which they disappeared, as if he could still hear Orpheus's voice inside him. "I wish he were dead," he said quietly. "A clever wish," replied Dustfinger. "But I'm afraid it's too late to make it come true." He had looked for Orpheus after the Piper was dead, but his room had been empty, like Thumbling's. The world looked so bright this cold morning. They were all so light at heart. But the darkness remained, and would go on telling its part of the story. They caught some of the horses left behind by the Adderhead's men. Although weakened by his wounds, Silvertongue was in a hurry. "At least let's save our daughters." "The Black Prince will have been looking after Meggie," Dustfinger told him, but the anxiety was still on his face as they rode farther and farther south. They were a silent company, all caught up in their own thoughts and memories.
Only Jacopo sometimes raised his clear voice, as demanding as ever.
"I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. When will we be there? Do you think the milksop has killed the children and the robbers?"
His mother always answered him, although often abstractedly. The castle in the lake had spun a bond between them out of shared fear and dark memories, and perhaps the strongest strand of it was the fact that Jacopo had done what his mother intended to do when she rode to the castle. The adder head was dead. But Dustfinger felt sure that all the same Violante would feel her father behind her like a shadow all her life, and very likely her ugliness knew it herself by now. Silvertongue took the blue jay away with him, too. It seemed as if the two of them were riding side by side, and not for the first time Dustfinger wondered whether they were only two sides of the same man. Whatever the answer was, the bookbinder loved this world as much as the robber did. On the first night, when they stopped to rest under a tree with furry yellow catkins falling from its bare branches, the swift came back. Although Risa had thrown the last of the seeds into the lake, she changed shape in her sleep and flew up into the flowering branches, where moonlight painted her plumage silver. When Dustfinger saw her sitting there, he woke Silvertongue, and they waited under the tree together until the swift flew down again at dawn and turned back into a woman there between them.
"What will become of the child?" she asked, full of dread.
"It will dream of flying," Silvertongue replied. Just as the bookbinder dreamed of the robber, and the robber of the bookbinder, and the fire dancer dreamed of the flames, and the minstrel woman who could dance like them. Perhaps, after all, this world was made of dreams, and an old man had merely found the words for them. Risa wept when they came to the cave and found it empty. But Dustfinger discovered the strong man's sign outside the entrance, drawn on the rocks in soot, and buried underneath was a message obviously left by Doria for his big brother. Dustfinger had heard of the tree with the nests in it that Doria described, but he had never seen it with his own eyes. It took them 2 days to find the tree, and Dustfinger was the first to see the giant. He took Silvertongue's reins, and Risa put her hand to her mouth in alarm. But Violante stared at the giant like an enchanted child. He was holding Roxanne in his hand, as if she too were a bird. Brianna turned pale at the sight of her mother between those mighty fingers, but Dustfinger dismounted and went up to the giant. The Black Prince was standing between the giant's vast legs, with the bear beside him. He was limping as he went to meet Dustfinger, but he looked happier than he had for a long time.
"Where's Meggie?"
asked Silvertongue, as the prince hugged him, and Batista pointed up into the tree. Dustfinger had never seen such a tree before, not even in the wild heart of the Wayless Wood, and he wanted to climb up to the nests at once and see the branches covered with frost flowers where the women and children perched, like birds. Meggie's voice called her father's name, and Silvertongue went to meet her as she let herself down the trunk on a rope, as naturally as if she had always lived in the trees. But Dustfinger turned and looked up at Roxanne. She whispered something to the giant, who put her down on the ground as carefully as if he believed she were made of glass. Roxanne. He vowed never to forget her name again. He would ask the fire to write its letters in his heart, so that not even the white women could wash it away. Roxanne. Dustfinger held her in his arms, and the giant looked down at them with eyes that seemed to reflect all the colors in the world.
"Look around,"
Roxanne whispered to him. And Dustfinger saw Silvertongue embracing his daughter and wiping the tears off her face. He saw the bookworm woman running to Risa. How in the name of all the fairies did she come to be here? Tullio, burying his furry face in Violante's skirt, the strong man almost smothering Silvertongue in his bear hug, and Farid. He stood there digging his toes into the newly fallen snow. He still went barefoot. And surely he'd grown taller. Dustfinger went up to him. "I see you've taken good care of Roxanne," he said. "Did the fire obey you while I was gone?"
"It always obeys me."
Yes, he had grown older. "I fought Sutbird."
"Imagine that.
My fire ate his fire."
"Did it indeed?"
"Yes, I climbed up on the giant and made fire rain down on Sutthard, and then the giant broke his neck.
Dustfinger couldn't help smiling, and Fareed returned his smile.
Do you have to go away again?
He looked as anxious as if he feared the white women were already waiting.
No, said Dustfinger, smiling again. No, not for a while, I think.
Fareed. He'd asked the fire to write that name in his heart as well. Roxanne, Brianna, Fareed, and Gwyn, of course.
Chapter 80. Ombra. When the Black Prince took the children back to Ombra, snow lay on the battlements above the city wall. But the women threw flowers they had made out of scraps of fabric cut from old clothes. The lion emblem waved from the city towers again, but now his paw was laid on a book with blank pages, and his mane was made of fire. The milksop had gone. He had fled from the giant, not to Ombra, but straight to the castle of Night and his sister's arms, and Violante had returned to take possession of the city and prepare it for the return of its children. Meggie was standing with Eleanor, Darius, and Fenolio in the square outside the castle gates, as the mothers hugged their sons and daughters, and Violante, speaking from the battlements, thanked the Black Prince and the Blue Jay for saving them.
"You know what, Meggie," Fenolio whispered to her,
as Violante had provisions from the castle kitchens distributed to the women.
"Maybe her ugliness will fall in love with the Black Prince some day. After all, he was the Blue Jay before your father took the part, and Violante was more in love with the role than the man anyway."
Oh, Fenolio, he was just the same as ever. Although the giant had gone back to his mountains, he had completely restored the old man's self-confidence. The Blue Jay had not come to Ombra. Mo and Risa had stayed behind at the farm where they had once lived.
"Let the Blue Jay go back to where he came from," he had told the prince, "into the strolling player's songs."
They were singing them everywhere already. How the Jay and the Fire Dancer, all by themselves, had defeated the Adderhead and the Piper with all their men.
"Please, Batista," Mo had said, "why don't you at least write a song telling the true story, about the people who helped the Jay and the Fire Dancer, about the Swift and the Boy?"
Batista had promised Mo to write a song like that, but Fenolio only shook his head.
"No one will sing it, Meggie. People don't like their heroes to need help, particularly not from women and children."
No doubt he was right. Perhaps that meant Violante would have a hard time on the throne of Ombra, although all its people were cheering her today. Jacopo stood beside his mother. He looked more like a small copy of his father every day, but all the same, he still reminded Meggie even more of his sinister grandfather. She shuddered to think how ready Jacopo had been to deliver the Adderhead up to death, even though that had been the saving of Mo. Another widow now ruled the country on the far side of the forest, and she too had a son and was taking care of the throne for him. Meggie knew that Violante expected war, but no one wanted to think of that today. This day belonged to the children who had come home. Not one of them was missing, and the strolling players sang about Fareed's fire, the tree full of nests, and the giant who had so mysteriously come out of the mountains at just the right moment.
"I'll miss him," Eleanor had whispered, as he disappeared among the trees,
and Meggie felt the same. She would never forget how the ink world was reflected on his skin, or how light-footed he was when he strode away, so gentle in such a big body.
"Meggie,"
Fareed made his way through the women and children,
"where's Silvertongue?"
"With my mother," she replied, and was surprised to find that her heart beat no faster than usual at the sight of him.
When had that changed?
Fareed frowned.
"Yes, yes," he said, "and Dustfinger's with his minstrel woman again. He kisses her so often, you might think her lips tasted of honey."
Oh dear, Fareed was still jealous of Roxanne.
"I think I'll go away for a while," he said.
"Go away? Where to?"
Behind Meggie, Eleanor and Fenolio began arguing over something Eleanor didn't like about the look of the castle. Those two loved arguing with each other, and they had plenty of opportunity for arguments because they were neighbors now, the bag in which Eleanor had packed all kinds of things that might come in useful in the Inkworld, including her silver cutlery, was still standing in her house in the other world.
Well, I was very excited. It's easy to forget such things, then.
But fortunately she had been wearing the Loredan family jewels when Darius read them both over, and Rosenquartz had sold them for her so cleverly.
Meggie, you've no idea what a shrewd businessman that glass man is.
That now she was the proud possessor of a house in the street where Minerva lived.
Where to?
Farid made a fiery flower grow between his fingers and placed it on Meggie's dress.
Oh, I think I'll just stroll from village to village, the way Dustfinger used to.
Meggie looked at the burning flower. The flames faded like real petals, and only a tiny spot of ash was left on her dress. Farid. His mere name used to quicken her pulse, but now she hardly listened as he told her about his plans, all the marketplaces where he would put on a show, the mountain villages, the far side of the Wayless Wood. Her heart leaped only when she suddenly saw the strong man standing there with the women. A few of the children had climbed onto his shoulders, just as they often used to in the cave, but she couldn't see the face she was looking for beside him. Disappointed, she let her eyes wander on and blushed when Doria was suddenly standing there in front of her. Farid abruptly fell silent and looked at the other boy in the same way as he so often looked at Roxanne. The scar on Doria's forehead was as long as Meggie's middle finger.
A blow with a spiked mace. Not particularly well aimed, Roxanne had said. Head wounds bleed a lot, so they probably thought he was dead.
Roxanne had nursed him for many nights on end, but Fenolio's opinion was still that Doria was alive thanks only to the story he had written long ago about the boy's future.
And anyway, even if you want to believe it was Roxanne who made him better, then who made up Roxanne, may I ask?
He was certainly his old self again.
Doria, how are you?
Meggie involuntarily put out her hand and caressed the scar on his forehead. Farid gave her a strange look.
Fine, my head's as good as new.
Doria brought something out from behind his back.
Is this what they're like?
Meggie stared at the tiny wooden airplane he had made.
That's how you describe them, isn't it? The flying machines?
But you were unconscious.
He smiled and put his hand to his head.
The words are in here all the same, but I don't know how the music thing is supposed to work. You know, the little box that plays music?
Meggie had to smile.
Oh yes, a radio. That wouldn't be any good here. I don't know just how to explain it to you.
Farid was still looking at her.
Then he abruptly took her hand. Excuse us, he told Doria, and led Meggie into the nearest doorway. Does Silvertongue know how you look at him?
Look at who?
Who?
He passed his finger over his forehead, as if tracing Doria's scar.
Listen, he said, stroking her hair back. Why don't you come with me? We could go from village to village together, the way we did when we and Dustfinger were following your mother and father. Do you remember?
How could he ask that? Meggie looked over her shoulder. Doria was standing beside Fenolio and Eleanor. Fenolio was looking at the airplane.
I'm sorry, Farid, she said,
gently removing his hand from her shoulder.
But I don't want to leave.
Why not?
He tried to kiss her, but Meggie turned her face away, even though she felt tears coming to her eyes.
Do you remember? I wish you luck, she said, kissing him on the cheek.
He still had the most beautiful eyes of any boy she'd ever seen. But now, her heart beat so much faster for someone else.
Chapter 81 Later
Almost 5 months later, a baby will be born at the lonely farm where the Black Prince once hid the Blue Jay. It will be a boy, dark-haired like his father, but with his mother and sister's eyes. He will think that every wood is full of fairies, that a glass man sleeps on every table, so long as there's some parchment on it, that books are written by hand, and that the most famous of illuminators paints with his left hand because his right hand is made of leather. He will think that strolling players breathe fire and perform comic plays in every marketplace, that women always wear long dresses, and that soldiers stand at every city gate. And he will have a great aunt called Eleanor, who tells him that there's a world that is not like this one, a world with neither fairies nor glassmen, but with animals who carry their young in a pouch in front of their bellies, and birds with wings that beat so fast it sounds like the humming of a bumblebee, with carriages that drive along without any horses, and pictures that move of their own accord. Eleanor will tell him how, long ago, a horrible man called Orpheus brought his parents out of that world and into this one by magic, and how this Orpheus finally had to flee from his father and the fire dancer to the northern mountains, where it's to be hoped he froze to death. She will tell him that even the most powerful men don't carry swords in the other world, but there are much, much more terrible weapons there. His father owns a very fine sword, kept wrapped in a cloth in his workshop. He hides it from the child, but sometimes the boy will secretly unwrap it and run his fingers over the shiny blade. Eleanor will tell him amazing things about that other world. She will even claim that the people there have built coaches that can fly, but he doesn't really believe that, although Doria has made wings for his sister, and Maggie really did fly from the city wall to the river wearing them. The boy laughed at her all the same, for he knows more about flying than Maggie. That's because he sometimes grows wings at night, and he and his mother fly up into the trees. But perhaps he's just dreaming it. He dreams it almost every night, but he'd like to see the flying coaches all the same, and the animals with pouches, the moving pictures, and the house that Eleanor is always talking about. A house full of books, not written by any hand. Books that are sad, because they're waiting for Eleanor. "Someday we'll go and visit them together," Eleanor often says, and Darius nods. Darius can tell wonderful stories, too, about flying carpets and genies in bottles. "Someday the three of us will go back, and then I'll show you all these things." And the boy runs to the workshop where his father is making leather clothes for books that are often illustrated with pictures painted by the famous Balbulus himself, and says, "Mo." He always calls his father Mo. He doesn't know why. Perhaps because that's what his sister calls him.
"When are we going to the other world? The one you came from?"
And his father puts him on his lap and runs his fingers through his dark hair and says, like Eleanor, "I'm sure we will someday. But we'd need words for that, exactly the right words, because only the right words unlock the doors between worlds. And the only person who could write them for us is a lazy old man. What's more, I'm afraid he's getting more forgetful every day." Then he tells him about the Black Prince and his bear, the giants that they'll go to see someday, and the new tricks the fire dancer has taught the flames. And the boy will see, in his father's eyes, that he is very happy and not at all homesick for the other world, any more than his sister is, or his mother. So the boy will think that perhaps he'll have to go alone one day, if he wants to see that world. And he'll have to find out which old man his father means, because there are several in Umbra. Maybe he means the one who has two glassmen and writes songs for the strolling players, and for Violante, whom everyone calls her kindliness, and who is much better liked than her son. Batista calls this old man Inkweaver, and Maggie sometimes goes to see him. Maybe he'll go with her next time, so that he can ask him for the words that open doors. Because it must be exciting in that other world. Much more exciting than in his own. This is Alan Corduna. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Ink Death by Cornelia Funke. This program was directed by Robert Kessler, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Original text copyright 2007 by Dressler Publishing. English translation 2008 by Anthea Bell. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible Kids hopes you have enjoyed this audiobook.
For more like it, check out kids.audible.com.